It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a federal appeals court in Chicago just reinstated Wisconsin's voter photo identification law. Our state government reporter will join us with the latest news and how the state is moving ahead.
First, it's the final installment of our series On the Rocks, a look at Wisconsin's alcohol culture. All week, we've been looking at different aspects of our state's relationship with drinking. Yesterday, we spoke with a 7-time OWI offender about her alcoholism and her recovery.
Today, we're taking a closer look at some solutions to Wisconsin's alcohol problems. Jeremy Arney is with us. He's Assistant Professor of Political Science and Public Administration at UW-La Crosse. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Well, I know you came here from Colorado. What was your impression of our use of alcohol here in the state?
Well, since my wife is originally from Wisconsin, we visited here several times before actually moving here from Colorado. And I often found myself commenting on how cheap the beer was in the stores and in the towny bars that we'd visit around her hometown. And don't get me wrong, living in Colorado is expensive, especially when you're a student. And so I had nothing at the time against cheap beer here in Wisconsin.
So, and that one idea you've researched is related to that, an idea to change the alcohol culture, you say, is raising the beer tax. How would an increased alcohol tax change things?
Well, although I'm not an economist, I've read several studies that address price controls, and it's always been seen as one of the best economic policy tools to get people to change their risky behavioral patterns. And so costing extra has been shown to help deter reckless drinking behavior among, say, teenage populations on fixed incomes. And all week you've been talking about on this show the high costs of alcohol-related incidences. And so raising alcohol taxes would increase revenue to help offset some of those costs and pay for treatment and prevention programs as well.
And it's been a while, you say, since we raised it too long, you say.
Well, in fact, 1969 was the last time, so the 45th anniversary is this October.
So what are the barriers? Why don't we raise that tax as some other places have done?
Well, there are many barriers. First of all, people don't like taxes in general, and tax increases even less. They don't like throwing their money into the abyss of a general fund where nobody knows exactly how it gets spent or what programs it's going to be spent on. And then on the other side, if you earmark the revenue for increases in prevention and treatment and enforcement, the politics of who gets what, when, and why come into play. You may need additional support from other advocacy groups for a tax increase to become successful, but at what point are there just too many hands in the pie and then the revenue just isn't enough to get spread out to become even useful?
So you like the idea, but you're not holding your breath.
No. And there's a big reason, probably bigger than that, is the political will is just not there, really. And it doesn't matter on either side of the aisle to raise alcohol taxes, but especially those currently in control of the legislative and executive branches. They're not interested in any type of tax increase soon. And as one of the legislators that I've interviewed in the past painted the picture to me like this, they said that there's a lot of rural areas in the state, and when you go back as a representative to one of these areas, you're going to be doing your campaigning in the local towny bar. And even if you only get, say, $100 or less in campaign donations, you're not going to tell your constituents that you're going to support an alcohol tax increase on the very same beer and alcohol that they're drinking socially all year round at that towny bar. So that's a political suicide in the drinking culture such as ours. So getting a beer tax increase an extremely uphill battle, both politically and culturally here in the state.
And before we move on from the beer tax idea, I mean, there are brewers in the state. There's the Tavern League. Do you see them having a lot of clout preventing this from being a realistic alternative?
Yes. In addition to those barriers, I'd say that alcohol policies are not something that the two parties are going to be butting heads over anytime soon. And I don't know if it really matters if the Tavern League has a strong input or say at this point, because they're not obviously spending any money lobbying for against a beer tax increase.
So moving away from a statewide solution or effort like a beer tax, you've made the case for community approaches. Why do you think local communities can take the lead on confronting alcohol culture here in the state?
Because I think that they feel the effects of risky drinking. They're more vivid to everyone that lives in the community. And so there's several, I've noticed around the state, because I work in alcohol policy, there's several grassroots approaches in communities around the state that are actually addressing the issue, and they include or attempting to include everyone in the community to help create these solutions at the local level.
Well, you're doing some work in La Crosse. So can you just paint us a broad picture of some of the community efforts you've got going there, and we'll drill down into some of them a little closer.
Sure, sure. Well, because of the river drownings that we had earlier, several of us formed a coalition to address risky drinking behavior at that time of just young adults between 18 and 25. And our coalition has had support from a tri-campus committee, which is made up of the leadership and student representations from all three campuses here in La Crosse. So first, we decided to approach taverns and the drinking establishments and ask if they would work with us to establish some harm reduction strategies and guidelines to help make La Crosse drinking establishments safer places to be patrons of. And our La Crosse Tavern League president said they'd be willing to look over a list of guidelines only if they were derived from their best customers, and that is the students. So I had my health policy students come up with some best practice ideas that they felt would work in La Crosse and would be presentable to the Tavern League. And then the Tavern League, they took it to the board and they accepted the suggestions. And over time, we had a voluntary agreement where they would abide by certain best practice standards. And then they were able to allow window clings to be put in the front window to advertise to clientele that they were supportive of adhering to some of these safer practices.
So if I'm a tavern keeper, yeah, what are some of the safer practices I need to agree to get that sticker in my window?
Responsible beverage service and training, so taking a tips course, your bartenders to help you identify people who have been overserved, offering more food options later into the night, having more availability of non-alcoholic beverages and discounts on those too, employees not being allowed to drink while they're on the job, which is a city ordinance anyway. And the real kicker that we found that really got people's attention was also no all-you-can-drink specials. And so in order to be part of the program, you had to abide by all of those guidelines.
And you've also, as a community effort, looked at Oktoberfest and the Oktoberfest parade there. That's a holiday definitely associated with beer. What are you doing along those lines?
Well, this is our fourth year that we've offered a prime location along the parade route that is entirely alcohol-free. So there's plenty of bleachers, fun activities for the kids to participate in, and everyone is given a free T-shirt. So a sea of 700 family-zoned participants stand out to those that go to the parades, and also those that actually walk in the parade. They stop and they get involved and interact with the crowd, and we've noticed that the bands will stop and play because they have such a larger cohesive crowd listening to them, a captive audience, so to speak. So it's been very successful. We had to go to the city council in order to get a permit to do that, and over the years, the Oktoberfest organization themselves have been really helpful and supportive because they want to also bring the image of it just being a beer-drinking event back to a family-oriented event.
Well, and what's the response been from the families? Are they showing up for a less beer-focused Oktoberfest?
I believe the families are, and I think that we've seen, each year we've seen incremental increases in the numbers of people that are showing up. And so I think our first year we had around 300, 350 people, and now last year we had around 700, and this year we expect even more. People just like the fact that they can come and watch the parade and not have to worry about people spilling beer on them or being rude and doing all kinds of other things. It's a peaceful, it's fenced off. And if anyone comes in that's drinking alcohol, they're told to leave. So it's highly enforced, too, and it does the trick.
And one more, you mentioned a big target audience is college students. You've started an effort called Party Zero in the La Crosse area. What is that?
Well, I didn't start the effort, but I've been impressed with the effort.
Okay.
It started in Oshkosh. And a student that graduated from there last year came to our campus and talked to a couple fraternities on our campus and then several leaders as well. And basically, it's just students holding alcohol-free social events off campus, outside of campus. And so they're there are parties just like any other party you'd think in college that has DJs, dancing, lawn games, competitions, gift bags, and all that stuff, which is donated by the local businesses. But they even play beer pong, and just without the beer, so soda or whatever non-alcoholic beverage they want to consume. And the effort, they had their first party last Friday. And the president of the fraternity said that there was at least, at one point, there was 300 people there, and consistently there was 100 people there until 1 a.m. So this is good news. There's alternative things for students to actually participate in besides the drinking culture.
We're talking to Jeremy Arney of UW-La Crosse now about some community-based solutions to Wisconsin's alcohol problems.
And we're taking your calls on this. What is your community doing to combat the prevalence of alcohol? And what are you doing to promote a healthier relationship with alcohol? What do you think needs to be done to cut down on the negative consequences of drinking in Wisconsin? If you've got ideas, we're interested to hear them. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send email to talk@wpr.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now with Jeremy Arney of UW-La Crosse about solutions to Wisconsin's troubled relationship with alcohol.
And we're taking your calls now. What do you think needs to be done to solve Wisconsin's alcohol problems? Are there things going on in your community to try to change our relationship, our culture when it comes to alcohol? How do you think the state should address this problem? How do you think local communities should do it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller now. We've got Joe on the line in Oshkosh. Joe, hi.
Hi. Well, you know, I've been listening to most of the programs through the week, and most of the emphasis really has been on what I would classify as formal social controls, that is laws and regulations, health care policies, et cetera. Really, the only long-term solution to changing alcohol culture is through informal social controls. And those are mainly interventions by family, friends, people who have some relationship, significant relationship to the person who's having problems. And what we don't do in our culture at all is we don't teach people how to intervene on alcohol problems informally, and we don't have a prohibition against drunkenness. The emphasis is on alcoholism, drunken driving, and especially any drinking at all. And in cultures where any drinking at all is bad, can drunkenness be any worse? And for the most part, it's not. And that's what's really lacking in our culture, is we do not have this cultural prohibition against drunkenness.
Gotcha, Joe. Thanks a lot for the call. Let's tackle that first point, or the second point first, Jeremy. And it kind of feeds in. I mean, if we tie together the three things you were talking about, that party zero, the alcohol-free parties on campuses, the alcohol providers, the taverns trying to serve more responsibly, and that Oktoberfest, the beer-free portion of Oktoberfest, part of that seems like it's geared toward changing our assumption that recreation has to involve alcohol.
Yes, definitely. That is the attempt. And specifically, I mean, Joe had mentioned individuals, and so interventions done by an individual's peer groups or family. And I think that we were taking it further to not just 18 to 25-year-olds with the party zero, but also family aged, you know, people that are older in their 30s or whatever, that you don't need alcohol and you can go have a good time with your kids without it. So I think that's correct too. And also I hope to get as a theme throughout here is that specifically, if you want to change the culture of risky drinking between 18 and 25-year-olds, you better have buy-in and active participation in that changing of the culture by the 18 to 25-year-olds. And I think in some of the community approaches that we talked about today, and then we didn't get to assessing festivals either, but that's something that we utilize young adults to go out and observe their community and actually see that. And then they tell their peers that, look, I went to this festival and I saw how much people were drinking. I saw how big the containers were. I saw how cheap it was. All of those things are conducive to changing the culture.
And you talked to some festival organizers, too, I think. What did you talk to them about in regards to alcohol?
Well, So like I mentioned, we had students, mostly students looking for part-time work, and other people go to the various festivals. We have a ton of festivals here in La Crosse throughout the year. And so they would observe whether or not people are being overserved, whether volunteers are drinking while they're performing their duties, like I mentioned, size of containers, like our pitchers being used. And after we collected all that data, we gave feedback to the festival organizers about the safety levels or lack thereof from our observations. And in the past, when we first started this, we got all of them together in the same room and shared the aggregate data of what we found, and then discussed amongst, and then they let them discuss amongst each other what they found to be the best practices, what made their event run more smoothly, switching to aluminum cans or shutting down alcohol services an hour earlier or telling volunteers they can't drink. And I thought it was really useful to give them that feedback, and then so they would address it. Currently, we don't bring them all together again, but we still send them letters with their results and then an open invitation that we'll come and discuss those results with them at their leisure.
We'll go back to our callers. We've got Mary on the line in Milwaukee. Mary, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I would like to tell you something that just happened to me this afternoon. My husband and I are driving west from Milwaukee right now, and we were on North Avenue. And there's a tavern, I won't name them, but they had a sign outside, and the sign said, $12 all you can drink. I was so appalled by it, and this is a UWM neighborhood. There's a couple of UWM dormitories, actually, just a few blocks away from this tavern. So I tried to think, who could I talk to about this, and I didn't have any luck with directory assistance trying to call the tavern itself. So I ended up calling the local police district, and I got a clerk on the line, and I tried to explain to him that I wanted to talk to somebody in crime prevention or something about it. He wouldn't put me through to anyone, and when we're going away for the weekend, but when I get back to Milwaukee next week, I would like to get in touch with either my alderman or the tavern owner or UWM and talk to them about how appalling this $12 all you can drink offer was to me.
Mary, thanks. And that brings up a really interesting point, Jeremy. If someone in a community sees something they don't like, whether it's these all-you-could-drink specials or something else, and they think, gosh, I think this is a problem, they're one person. Where do they start? How do they start trying to reach out to their community or their electeds?
That's a great problem to try to solve in an area like Milwaukee. Because I don't know of the various coalitions that are affiliated with, alcohol use and abuse. In Milwaukee, I've actually been to Milwaukee to conferences and talked to people there that are getting neighborhoods started, neighborhood groups started, but just haven't gotten there. But I think your alderman's a great place to start, as you mentioned, city council, even your local law enforcement. But UWM has to have some kind of alcohol resource, counseling center or something like that that she could call and maybe they can connect her, like network her with someone in her community that they can get together and address this issue. Because it is a business practice, and until we realize that it's a bad business practice, it's going to keep happening.
And you've got a coalition in the La Crosse area working on a lot of these issues. What happened to make that happen, to bring people together and start trying to work on solutions?
Well, unfortunately, it originally came about because of the drownings, the high number of drownings that we had from student age populations in La Crosse. And so that enough caused the universities to get together, and then the universities, a committee on the university, which turned into our coalition. And we've applied, as most coalitions do, or most nonprofits and advocacy organizations, we applied for grants and were able to apply for grants in the Wisconsin state area and had the resources, had people that we knew that would help us in the grant writing process, and then just wrote them and submitted them. And we had, and also it didn't hurt that La Crosse was ranked like in the top four binge drinking counties of the state. So that alone and the drownings helped our cause to get those funds to help address that issue.
Well, do you think outside of your area, do you think enough people in Wisconsin are concerned about the alcohol culture to do what they're doing in La Crosse to come together and try to make some changes?
Well, thankfully, I spent hopefully the last 20 minutes or so answering yes to that question. I think that there are plenty of people, organizations, and groups around the state that are making changes, and I'm excited about these new approaches being driven by the younger population to further cultural change here in Wisconsin. So I'm optimistic about this. I've lived here for 7 years, and this is the most involved I've seen communities get together and address this issue together at a community level.
Bring it back to where we started. If communities keep doing this, do you think the state as a whole will follow? The state government as a whole would follow?
You would hope, right?
All right, we'll leave it there.
We'll leave it there. There are political boundaries that might interfere with that, but you know, if we start getting back to being able to elect our officials and them not determining who elects them, then I think we'll have a good shot at that change at the legislative level too.
Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciated it.
That was Jeremy Arney, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Public Administration at UW-La Crosse. He was with us for this final installment of our week-long series, On the Rocks, a look at Wisconsin's alcohol culture.
You can take a look back at each installment of the series and post your comments at WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret, and this is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday, and our guest says waffle irons are for more than just waffles, and he's got the recipes to prove it.
First, the U.S. Seventh Circuit Court heard arguments in Wisconsin's voter ID case today. After a nearly three-year legal battle, a panel of three Republican-appointed judges will now decide if the Wisconsin law requiring voters to show photo ID at the polls should be reactivated in time for the elections this November.
Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson was in Chicago to hear the arguments, joins us now for an update. Sean, it's good to have you back.
Good to be back.
So what was the tone like in court today?
The tone was, you know, having seen a few of these arguments before federal court recently, there have been arguments where the lawyer will get up there to make his or her case, and about a minute in, the judges will cut them off. You didn't see that when the Wisconsin Department of Justice got up there to make their case about why voter ID should be reinstated in Wisconsin. The judges heard them out, and really their tougher questions were directed at the plaintiffs for the ACLU and other groups representing voters who sued successfully to overturn voter ID at the district court level. The judges want to know really the basis of that, and you know, seem to be trying to get at whether they could, see making a similar ruling at the appeals court level. But they seem to have some serious issues with it.
What do we know about the judges hearing the case?
You had three judge panel: Judge Easterbrook, Judge Sykes, Judge Tinder. They're all appointed by Republican presidents. Judge Sykes, Diane Sykes, a former Wisconsin Supreme Court justice, kind of a conservative darling in Wisconsin prior to her ascent to the federal appeals bench. Judge Easterbrook actually hearing another high-profile Wisconsin case, heard it this week, an offshoot of one of our John Doe investigations here in Wisconsin. But Easterbrook, somebody who's pretty widely respected, I think, in the federal court system. And Easterbrook and Sykes really dominated discussion today. Sykes, in particular, signaled where she was viewing this from. And, you know, she said a few things. She said that the eve of the election is upon us, as she was asking, you know, what are we going to do here? She also repeatedly referenced the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in another voter ID case and said, look, the Supreme Court has established that states have a real interest, a viable interest in regulating, in passing laws to prevent election fraud. And she also said, Going through my notes here, those were a couple of the points that she made, you know, repeatedly. The other thing she said was that the Wisconsin Supreme Court had basically taken care of the cost issue when it comes to voter ID. Wisconsin Supreme Court issued a ruling in another lawsuit recently where Justice Patience Rogensack upheld voter ID, but at the same time, kind of in a footnote, told the Wisconsin DMV, look, you can't charge for IDs. You can't require documents that come at a cost to get those voter IDs. You're not a party to this lawsuit, but look, figure this out. And so this week, just a couple days ago, the DMV came out and said, we have a system now to deal with that. The Wisconsin Department of Justice brought that up in court today. And Diane Sykes said from the bench, the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision took care of the cost issue.
All right, so that's off the table in terms of the undue burden factor, then.
In her eyes, the ACLU attorneys bringing this suit obviously have a different take. You did not hear Judge Easterbrook or Judge Tinder make such strong assertions from the bench, so you don't know where they're coming from on this. You did hear Judge Easterbrook, though, question, you know, why we should let a district judge, Judge Edelman, who overturned voter ID at the district level, why let him make an assertion that there is no state interest or that in regulating voter fraud when the U.S. Supreme Court has said otherwise?
And one of the questions on the table is, should the voter ID law be upheld, could it be implemented? Could it be up in action by the November elections? And I understand the judges put that out there, that question on the table.
Yeah, I mean, I would say up until today's hearing, at least I've been operating under the assumption that voter ID would not be in effect for this November's elections. You know, the thought being that the legal process moved slow until recently. It was tied up not only in federal court, but in state court. After today's hearing, I'm not so sure. I mean, the lawyer for the Wisconsin Department of Justice said, why don't you just issue a stay today, take care of this, put it back on the books. You didn't hear any of the judges say, like, you're crazy or we're not going to move that fast. And Judge Sykes said, you know, that the eve of the election is upon us. And I actually, the reaction from the ACLU attorneys after the hearing, I thought was sort of telling. They very forcefully said, no court has ever reinstated a law like this close to an election. And to do that would be just catastrophic. It'd be an invitation for disaster. They seem to be taking that threat very seriously.
So just based on what you're saying, it looks like that's something that could happen.
It definitely looks like something that could happen. I guess the caution you have to throw to this is that judges often play devil's advocate when they're in arguments. They want to kind of try to find weak spots in the argument. And so it's possible that's what they were doing here. I don't think that's what Justice Sykes was doing, though. I think we know where she stands. The question is whether one of the other judges is going to stand with her in this.
Is this decision likely to impact this question elsewhere in the country?
Yes, because they brought kind of a novel argument in Wisconsin. I mean, voter ID laws have been challenged elsewhere. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled on them elsewhere. The challenge they brought in Wisconsin was based on Section 2 of the Voter Rights Act. Normally, that's applied to redistricting cases. The attorneys in this case said it fit in Wisconsin because just statistically, they said a voter ID law requiring a photo ID to vote is more apt to deter minority voters from casting a ballot. And so they brought this Section 2 challenge. And, you know, if they were to prevail here, this they did at the district level, if they were to prevail in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, I think you'd definitely see that challenge repeated elsewhere in the country. You know, I don't know that that's going to happen. I mean, a lot of the questions, which were more technical in nature from Judge Easterbrook, seem to be getting at, how do we measure this? You know, is there a percentage of voter turnout that makes it a violation of Section 2 or a percentage of people who have the IDs? How do we make this ruling that can be replicated in other courtrooms?
Now, recently we saw the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeal handing down a decision on Wisconsin's gay marriage ban with incredible speed. Do you have a sense of the pacing on this one?
No. I mean, I guess I wouldn't be surprised if it happened fast. But that decision was handed down much faster than usual for the federal court system. I think if they were to move quickly, it would be to stay the Judge Adelman's ruling, and they could issue their own decision later. But really, the clock is ticking. We're pretty close. We're less than 2 months from the election. So to get this new law up and working that quickly, as the ACLU attorneys said, you know, it's a tall order. It's something Wisconsin hasn't had for an election like this, of this level of turnout in its history. So, yeah, the clock is ticking.
All right, Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol reporter, talking about the arguments in Wisconsin's voter ID case heard at the Seventh Circuit Court. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday, and today we're having breakfast for dinner and lunch and everything in between. Our guest is a waffle-making genius, and there's almost nothing he hasn't tried to waffle.
Daniel Shumsky joins us now. He's the creator of the waffleizer.com website and the author of the book Will It Waffle? 53 Unexpected Recipes to Make in a Waffle Iron. Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
So you've made it pretty much your mission in life to figure out every possible application for the waffle iron. So I guess my question for you is why? What do you like so much about waffling your food?
Well, here's the reason it came about, which is that I do love my waffle iron, and it is sort of my mission to make it more useful because I don't love this idea that there are appliances that are only good for one thing and just taking up counter space the rest of the time.
And you give a little waffle history before we get into the recipes, including the history of the waffle frolic. Do you have a favorite moment in waffle history?
You know, what was really interesting to me when I was researching the book was finding out that waffles and waffle irons sort of go back to the founding of our country. So when Thomas Jefferson came back from France in 1789, one of the things that he is said to have brought back was a waffle iron.
And the one that really got me was that the Nike shoe company owes its origins to waffles.
Yeah, absolutely. Apparently the sole of the shoe initially was put into a waffle iron, and so that it had that sort of grid pattern on the bottom.
And how far back, you mentioned the dawn of American history, do waffles go back even further?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the reasons that we have these sort of pressed discs of dough is because in the medieval times that you can trace them back to communion wafers.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, as far as the modern-day waffle, we'll say we want to buy in and start cooking our own waffles and other things. What do we need?
Well, here's what I tell people, which is that I get the question a lot, what's the best waffle iron to get? And I tell people, you know, there's a really good chance that you already have a waffle iron collecting dust in your cabinet or on top of the refrigerator, or maybe a relative of yours has one that they don't use. And that's really the number one indispensable piece of equipment is a waffle iron. And beyond that, there are a handful of tools, like maybe a nonstick, a silicone spatula and some nonstick spray, but that's about it.
How many waffle irons do you have?
I don't know if I should admit this, but I have 6 waffle irons.
Are they all different?
Yeah, they're all different. One of the things that was really important to me when I was doing the recipes for this book was making sure that, you know, when I was asking the question, will it waffle, I wanted to make sure that the answer was consistent across the board so that when people use the recipes in the book, no matter what kind of waffle iron they had, it would work. So I was testing it in a bunch of different waffle irons.
Now, to be clear, when you ask the question, will it waffle, we're not just talking about making up batter and making waffles. That's a small part of your book. You are on a mission to find out what you can and cannot waffle in this world.
That's right. That is exactly right. So I know that waffle batter will waffle, right? But the question in writing the book was, well, look, that's great. I love waffles, but what else can we make in the waffle iron? And so we're talking about a whole range of foods from breakfast, lunch, dinner, dessert, talking about things like cookies and quesadillas and all sorts of things.
Well, you've got some fans out there. We heard from a listener named Nick in Milwaukee already who says, waffled hash browns and waffled cookies spin me super happy, but I'm wondering if you have conquered waffled lasagna. If so, please share the recipe. Now, I don't think that one is in your book. At least I didn't see it. But can we get close to something similar to waffled lasagna?
Maybe. Let me first, I have to put in a little plug for the waffled hash browns because those are amazing. You don't even have to flip them and both sides get crispy from the two-sided heat of the waffle iron. It's Like, I don't know why anybody makes hash browns any other way.
That is usually the challenge with hash browns, is that you have one layer that has some brown and the rest of it is just kind of white and mushy.
Yeah, or you have to sit there and futz with it to get it to brown in all the right places, right? But the waffle iron takes care of all of that for you, and it comes out with this fantastic grid pattern on it. It's one of my favorite recipes in the book.
Sir, you're dodging the question.
No, what,
how close can we get to lasagna on the waffle iron?
So what I will tell you about waffle lasagna is I haven't tried it yet.
Huh.
I do know that in the book has a recipe for spaghetti with waffled meatballs.
Hmm.
So I wouldn't say that the pasta area is unexplored, but the lasagna has not yet, I haven't tackled that one yet.
Does that get a little crispy, the spaghetti and meatballs on the waffle iron?
Well, you make the pasta as you normally would, and then you make the meatballs in the waffle iron, and they end up with these divots, these nooks and crannies that sort of collect the sauce.
Wow, that does sound good. Well, you do get a little close to the lasagna in a recipe that I think is genius, waffled mac and cheese.
Yes. I love the waffled mac and cheese because this is, again, where that two-sided heat of the waffle iron really pays off. You get the nice, crunchy exterior and then the melty, gooey, cheesy inside.
And breadcrumbs turned out to be the secret.
Yeah, what I found was that if you waffled the mac and cheese without sort of an insulating layer of breadcrumbs, it kind of fell apart. So that little bit of breadcrumb not only adds a bit of crunch, but it kind of protects the mac and cheese inside.
Well, we're sharing one of your egg recipes on our Facebook page, Central Time Facebook page. It's eggs migas? Migas?
Yes. Migas, yeah.
Migas. So tell us about that one.
So what I love, there are a few recipes in the book that use eggs in the waffle iron, which is maybe not what you would normally think to cook in the waffle iron. This one is a little bit of a Latin touch. It's sort of a scrambled eggs with a little bit of a Latin flavor to it. And you mix up some eggs with some tortilla and some tomato and onion, and you put it all in the waffle iron and close the waffle iron, and when you open it up a few minutes later, you've got this, essentially it's a scrambled egg waffle is maybe the best way to describe it.
And it looks really delicious. So that's a breakfasty one. That's not pushing the boundaries too far, but it's definitely taking a new spin on it. And the other recipe that we're sharing is a recipe for red velvet cake ice cream sandwiches.
Oh, yeah, man. I had to test that one a lot when I was writing the book.
Oh, poor you.
Yeah, poor me is right. The thing about that I love is that, you know, I think red velvet waffles are maybe not terribly surprising, but what I was really looking for with this one was to replicate that sort of cookie texture that you get when you're eating an ice cream sandwich. And so what you are looking at when you see this is these two beautiful sort of scarlet red waffles on either side, sandwiching some vanilla ice cream in the middle and then chocolate chips. You know, the ice cream is dunked in chocolate chips, so it's sort of studded with the chocolate chips on the outside.
I just keep asking myself as I read your book and hear you talk about these things, why am I not eating this right now?
We've been really hungry this morning getting ready for this interview, I have to confess.
Yeah. So another one in the dessert category, following about the red velvet, that I really like the sound of, the s'more waffle, the s'moreful, I think is how you build it.
Yeah, the s'moreful. That is a genius idea. I can't even take all the credit for that one. I had a friend who owned a chocolate shop, and when I came to her with an idea of making things in the waffle iron that weren't waffles, she said, we've got to try s'mores. And so, you know, I had no argument. I was happy to try it. And this is one of these, I can't even tell you how fun this is to do. You make graham cracker dough, and then you make that in the waffle iron, and then you sandwich chocolate and marshmallow between the two graham cracker dough pieces, and you put it all together in the waffle iron, and it just gets so delicious and melty and gooey. It's amazing.
So you've obviously experimented with tons of recipes and, you know, even more on your Waffleizer website. But what is your favorite thing to make? What is your go-to waffle recipe?
Oh, man. You're putting me on the spot here. I think I gravitate sometimes toward the things that are just quicker and easier to do in the waffle iron. So let's just take something. There's a few of the recipes. Those are the recipes in the book. But let's take something like the waffle quesadillas, where when you're making a quesadilla, what you really want is heat from both sides, and you don't want it to, you know, take too long, right? And the waffle iron is the perfect machine to use for quesadillas.
Great. Well, we should probably put in a plug for something healthy. You got any good veggies that work really well on the waffle iron?
There are a ton of veggie recipes in the book. One of my favorites is the waffled zucchini parmesan fritters.
Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also a waffled portobello mushroom in there.
So what does that do? Let's take the mushroom. How does that serve us to cook that in a waffle iron?
Well, I think one of the things to always consider is that you've got two things going on here. You've got the two-sided heat of the waffle iron, so it makes it quicker than other things, other methods of cooking. And the other thing to consider, I think, is that, you know, we eat with our eyes first, and everything that comes out of the waffle iron ends up with this kind of fun grid pattern on it. And when something is just looks out of the ordinary, it looks a little fun, looks a little more different, it sets your expectations a little bit higher. It's kind of an adult way to play with your food.
And somebody, when I told them we were doing this show, was like, well, why not just use one of those home electric grills? Why does it have to be a waffle iron? What is it about the waffle and the grid that makes it better?
Well, that takes me back to one of the things that we talked about a little bit where with the waffle spaghetti and meatballs. Mm. So when you get the waffle, the texture in there, those nooks and crannies, it's perfect for collecting sauce. And that comes up with the waffled falafel, too, because you can spread some hummus on there, and it just settles in those divots, and it's perfect.
Plus, waffle falafel is really
awesome.
Fun to say.
Yes, it is as fun to say as it is to eat, for sure.
Now, we've been talking about all this crazy stuff there that we have to try a little different, but what about if you just want to make waffles in your waffle iron? Do you have a favorite recipe for that?
I do. So there are 53 recipes in the book for things to make in your waffle iron that are not waffles, but I didn't feel like I could write this book without including a couple recipes for waffles. So if you go all the way to the back of the book, there are two of my favorite waffle recipes. And probably my favorite of the two is the yeast-risen overnight waffle.
All right. Well, Daniel, sounds great. You've made us all really hungry. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Daniel Shumsky is the creator of Waffleizer.com and the author of the book Will It Waffle? 53 Unexpected Recipes to Make in a Waffle Iron.
And we've got those recipes for red velvet ice cream sandwich waffles and waffled eggs migas up on the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.